acquired taste, and the second one is what goes with preachers that have to preach at conference. Right? You don't want this job, do you? You open your Bibles to Romans chapter 1. I was blessed by the devotional meditation, especially Brother Sonny's thought that I should have wrote it down so I could have it verbatim. But the whole idea that the only way that we will see God after we are called is to do what he says. I know that at least some of you have been tempted already to give up, to call it quits. So have I. I guess we know that that is a sure recipe for destruction. As I was encouraged by that. Romans chapter 1, I want to look at a few verses here in the introduction of the book of Romans. And the truth that is on my heart to teach this morning, we could have used the verses that Brother Sonny read as well. Because I'm not so much looking right now to read a truth out of the scriptures, but to use the scriptures to illustrate a truth that I believe to be true. And if we learn it and use it, it will be an advantage to our calling. Romans chapter 1, verse 8. First, I thank my God through Christ, Jesus Christ, for you all, that your faith is spoken throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you in my prayers, making request, if by any means now at length I might have a prosperous journey by the will of God to come unto you. For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end that ye may be established, that is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith of you and me. Now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oft times I purposed to come unto you, but was let hitherto, that I might have some fruit among you, even as among other Gentiles. I am a debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. I tried to emphasize every time I ran across I. And the reason I did that is because there's a lot here. Have you ever heard someone say that we shouldn't talk about ourselves in our preaching and our teaching? Many, many years ago, as a young man, I was assigned to become a Pilgrim Witness editor. And those of you that have served in that role know that there is a duty that goes with it called write some editorials. And with trembling hand and quivering heart and all the other strong emotions that go with that, I put something together and submitted it. And then the reviewers got back to me. And what they told me was that my article had a disease. They said, it has the disease of you-itis in it. He said, you shouldn't write like that. You. He said, when an article has you-itis and itis in it, why, it takes away from the truth and people can't see it. And so they asked me to take the I out of my article, and so I did. And for the rest of my time as a Pilgrim Witness editor, I not only tried to avoid that, but I made sure that it was taken out before it went to those reviewers because I knew they would fuss about it again. But it was something that, and I don't actually hold it against them, I believe, because I don't remember who it was that lectured me on it. It was either Aaron or Sidney, one of the older bishops. And they had a point. I know that when it comes to taking your pen in hand, that there is a certain amount of personality that can be there, but if it's too much, it's too much. Okay? But I do remember thinking in the years that followed that I wondered if that was true the whole way through all writing and teaching and so forth. I would read through the New Testament and I would see that this Apostle Paul did an awful lot of it. If you counted the times I said I or my or me in this writing, it's 13 times in 9 verses. 2 Corinthians 12, my grace is sufficient for thee, for when I am weak, then I am strong. That passage in 11 verses, he uses the personal pronoun 26 times. Philippians chapter 1, in 8 verses, he uses it 11 times. Philippians chapter 3, brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, I follow after, that I might know him. That scripture, in 8 verses, he pulls the personal pronoun out for himself and talks to them and you 16 times in 8 verses. And in Philippians 4, I have learned whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. He does it in 6 verses, he does it 10 times, and so it was very much part of his writing and teaching style to pull his own experience and to use the first person pronoun to teach and to say, and we know that it's not all bad because when you look at this passage I read to you, and we get to verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, it has become a classic scripture. Those of you that were at the Cornerstone ordination heard Brother Steve use this passage as his text for how to be a good minister. And it was not a weak or a selfish presentation, but rather it was one that we looked at the life and the testimony of the Apostle Paul, and we said, and that's ours, and we claimed it. And there is a difference between this euitis that these brethren were concerned about and the whole testimony that a man writes of his own experience. This whole dynamic clicked into focus for me last summer when I was reading a new history book that had just come out, John Meacham's book, Songs of America. And it's not a must-read for anybody, but if you enjoy history, you might like this one. It's a book about the different songs that are in American history that are significant. And it's a lot of them are patriotic songs, the Star-Spangled Banner, America the Beautiful. There it goes, it left me. But there's just different ones that are part of our American history and what made them significant. But I was reading the book, and I came to about the third chapter, and he began to talk about one of the American songs and their popularity, and he begins to write about what made it so popular. In 1831, Reverend Samuel F. Smith, then a student at Andover Theological Seminary in Massachusetts, wrote a hymn to the nation that spoke in Websterian terms about the American experiment. A 24-year-old student, Smith had been reading over German patriotic hymns when he got the idea to compose one of his own. Seizing a scrap of waste paper, I began to write, and in half an hour, I think, the words stood upon it substantially as they are sung today. Smith recalls, the tune for which he wrote was God Save the King, the British national anthem popular since the mid-18th century. The title of Smith's piece was simple but profound. It was called America, which became known as My Country, 'Tis of Thee. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside let freedom ring. My native country, thee, land of the noble and free, thy name I love thy rocks and rills, thy woods and templed hills, my heart with rapture thrills like that above. And there's three more verses. But this was the song that the man wrote, a young 24-year-old man, and he took it to Sunday school. The history shows, and he taught it to the children on a Sunday afternoon after Sunday school was finished. And the amazing thing is that song, in a world without Google, without Facebook, without internet, without any of the props that we market and distribute today, it made it across the country in 2 years' time. And people marveled about what in the world happened there, that a 24-year-old could write a song in an age where there was barely a printing press and you could distribute it across the land. It had its own life. And people tried to speculate. And there was a man that you might have heard of already. His name was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a college student with Samuel Smith. And he wrote this in thinking about this song and what made it so popular. He writes this, what is fame? It is to write a hymn which 60 million people, that's America's population at that time, that is fame. Now, Holmes continues, "Now there's Smith. His name will be honored by every school child in the land when I have been forgotten for 100 years. He wrote, 'My country, 'tis of thee.' If he had said, 'Our country,' the hymn would not have been immortal. But that 'my' was a masterstroke. Everyone who sings the song at once feels a personal ownership that this is his native land. The hymn will last as long as the country." That's what a man said in observation of a man who wrote a song saying, "My country, I sing. This is mine." And he invites everybody else to pick up the strain and sing it with him. And they do. There are many illustrations of where that song was used to pull the people together. The story continues. The I versus we construction that Smith struck upon is an intriguing one. In the civil rights movement of the mid-20th century, Bernice Reagan would also see the power of the first-person pronoun. A scholar of American African music and culture, she says, "Sound is a way to extend the territory you affect. Anybody who comes into that space, as long as you're singing, they cannot change the air in that space. The song will maintain the air as your territory." And in our community, she was a black woman and she speaks to the black community. In our community, when you want the communal expression, everybody says I. So if there are five of us here and all of us say I, then you know there's a group. A lot of times I've found that when people say we, they're giving you cover to not say whether they're going to be there or not. Her example, then, is the little children's song, "This Little Light of Mine," which means that when a march goes forward, I'm going to be there. So it really is a way of saying, the life that I live, I will offer to this thing. "This little light of mine," the children sing, "I'm going to let it shine." Each one of them singing together. "Let it shine till Jesus comes, I'm going to let it shine." Not we, but I. And it's not a selfish thing at all, but it's an intriguing dynamic of how people are pulled together with the genius, as this writer says, the genius of the personal pronoun. And I think that you can go back and see this in essence. The difference between the first person personal and the first person plural is whether or not people are in or out. That's what these writers are saying. And in many ways, you can see it to be true. And this is something that has been effected in history again and again. There are stories all over the place. In 1862, there was There was the Emancipation Proclamation went forth, and after that, the slaves were freed. And one of the things that the slaves did for their survival is they went out into the Union camps and joined the army. Whole families would. And they would do that for their safety, they would do that for their sustenance, and they would also do it because they wanted to be part of what the Union was. And there's a story told in South Carolina where one day a group of people, black people, freed slaves, came walking down the road, and the whole group was singing, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty." And what was happening is the whole group had unified under the personal pronoun I and we, and they were saying, "This is mine, this is the air we breathe, and we're in it." Story is told of Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. One of their battles that they fought, the men went forth out into the skirmish singing this song. And as men began to fall, they continued to sing. And there were men laying there dying, still singing, "My country, 'tis of thee." Now those are human governments. And those are human, are personal or temporal. This is not the kingdom of heaven of which I speak right now. But I'm telling you that the dynamic is the same in the kingdom we are in. And if we know it and use it, it can help us. There's a story that of the power of the personal pronoun that is extremely moving. This took place in 1909. Well, I thought I brought it along. Here it is. 1909, over in England, in the Durham coalfields, a place called West Stanley Colliery, there was a mine, a very large mine. And February the 16th, 1909, Friday afternoon at 3:45, there was an explosion in the mines and many people died. Just gives a list here. The Townley Seam, 63 lay dead. The Tilly Seam, 18. Busty Seam, 33 dead. Brockwell Seam, 48 dead. But incredibly, there were still men left alive down there in the coal mine. And there was a group of men in the one seam, that the Tilly Seam, that had found a pocket of clean air. And the deputy who was in charge called the men together, and he said, "We're going to go over here, and we're just going to wait till rescue comes." Well, there was a number of men that weren't satisfied with that, and they galloped off and got into a vein that had deadly gas, and they all perished. And so the men huddled down, and the story is told that as they huddled there, one of the men began to hum, then sing an old hymn that we know. "Lead, kindly light, amid the encircling gloom, lead thou me on." And he just goes on. "The night is dark, I am far from home." And it's a very touching scene when you think of the tragedy and the darkness that's in that moment. But here is a man, and he begins to sing. And it's a very personal hymn. "The distance, I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough for me. I was not ever thus, nor prayed that thou should lead me on. I love to choose and see my path, but now lead me on. I loved the garish day in spite of fears. Pride ruled my will. Remember not past years." And the story goes on that one by one, the men began to sing. And when the song was finished, they were quiet. Nobody was running around anymore. They discovered young Jimmy Gardner had passed away while they were singing. But the story says that they stood and sat and waited for their rescue some 14 hours in quietness. And what you see happening is that the personal power of I and my rallied those men together to a common point. Could they have sung "Lead Us On"? Could they have sung "We Love the Garish Day"? Could they have sung "We Don't See Ahead, Give Us One Step"? They probably could have. But I propose that it would not have dominated their spirits as each man breathed the air of the first one, "Lead Me On." And this is something that is true of the human experience. And you will find it being used in the scriptures. You will find it being used in our lives. And I would like to hold that it is something that as church leaders, as followers of Jesus Christ, we can use it ourselves. This talk of Paul, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ," was not his bragging. It was nothing more than him saying, "This is the air I breathe. Will you breathe it with me?" Have you ever sung the song, "For I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day"? That's one of Paul's testimonies. And somebody took that into a song, and on a Sunday morning, between Sunday school and the ministry, the preaching, a congregation will stand, and voice by voice by voice will lift their voices in song, and they will all sing together, "For I know whom I have believed, and I am persuaded that he is able." And it's Bernice Reagan calls it the communal power of I. It's just a label. And if you want to give this sermon a title, that's what I gave it. I'm talking about this communal power of I that is available and powerful if we use it. Have you ever been to a Sunday morning service and the devotional leader says, "Now this morning, I want to take you to an old familiar song. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down." And maybe he'll say it by memory, maybe he'll read it, maybe he'll do it responsively, and maybe he'll ask everyone to stand and recite it together with him. All of those are easy possibilities, because we all know that. But what happens is that as we move down through there, we start out with us, and we're together at Tyrone, or whatever your congregation or assembly is. And there you are, and you recite, and you read, and you say. But by the time we get down to verse 4, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow of death," this whole group of people has lost themselves, and they're thinking about the valley they're in. Or they're thinking about the valley that's ahead of them and they see it. Or they're thinking about valleys that they've come through. And yet the hearts are being knit together by a shepherd who wrote one day, "The Lord is my shepherd." And we do this with the Psalms, and we ought to do it. It's the communal of power of I that is full exposure, full practice. Go to Ezra chapter 9. I want to show you another way that this can be practiced. Ezra chapter 9, you have a high priest that comes to Jerusalem, or a priest, I should say. And he wants to serve the Lord, and he wants to lead the people. But he's not there long until he discovers that there is great apostasy in the people. Some pretty tragic things that are happening. They're intermarrying with the people of the land. The very thing that had been responsible for their destruction, there was other things, but this was one of them, was now being practiced all over again. And it says in verse 5, at the evening sacrifice, Ezra 9, "I arose from my heaviness, having rent my garment and my mantle. I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands unto the Lord my God and said, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head. Our trespasses groan unto the heavens." You see him starting out with the personal pronoun. This is who I am, and this is where we are. And the amazing thing about this story is that while he prayed, this personal prayer, while he prayed, the people were assembling. In Ezra chapter 10, verse 1, "Now when Ezra had prayed that personal prayer, and when he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, there assembled unto him out of Israel a very great congregation of men and women and children, for the people wept very sore." This was not a well-meaning pastor wagging his finger and roaring the scriptures at a wayward people. This was a pastor that fell on his face before the Lord and began to pray. And as the people heard him pray, it pulled them in. And they began to breathe that same air that Ezra was breathing. And repentance began. And it's an incredible thing to think about how a leader moved his people by stating where he was and inviting his people to come stand with him or kneel with him in this story. It's the communal power of I in full display. Now, sometimes we can understand a concept better if we break it down into small pieces. And I want to try to do that a little bit this morning. I want to point out a couple ingredients that are in this whole dynamic of where a person starts a song and everybody joins in and it becomes their song, but it's a personal song. Or a person starts a prayer and it's a personal prayer and it becomes their prayer. Because of it. When you think about it, I would like to show you three ingredients that I can see in this little dynamic of the communal expression, the communal power of I. Number one is what I will label the offering. This is the starting point. This is where the person prepares and puts forth the air. Paul wrote to the Romans. Samuel Smith wrote a song. Ezra prayed for the people, and a minor began to sing. Okay? For the communal expression of I to have any kind of life, it will require that somebody does something, okay? And you don't want to miss that, because if we look to use this in our own lives and in our own ministry, we need to understand that nothing will happen until something happens. And in these illustrations, it began with a person, like I said, starting a song, writing a letter, praying a prayer. You have that starting point. But all of these offerings will begin personally. You cannot write, "My country, 'tis of thee," without having the love of the country in your heart first. It was in his heart to write a patriotic song in the natural illustration that I gave. Paul had a love. If you had read all of Romans 1, if you read the introductions like Sonny told us, you will see that his love for his Christ was first, and out of that is where the testimonies came forward. But all of the offerings, when the communal expression of I takes place, all of the offerings will be in the personal tone, the personal tense. It's mine. Not because we're proud, not because we think we are somebody, but because we are driven by desires. We are driven by loves. A man named Ezra wants to get right with God. And he personally wants to do that. And this is how the whole expression starts, the offering of myself. The second ingredient that I see in the communal expression of I, the communal power of I, is the invitation. Paul writes the letter and he sends it to Romans. And the Romans pick up this letter and they begin to read. And they read his personal testimony. And just like us, when we read it, Romans 1, we read it and we say, he writes, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. And you feel in your heart that you have to make a decision. Will I be ashamed of the gospel of Christ or won't I? Okay? And this is the invitation phase of the communal expression of I, where the song, the prayer, the whatever, the expression is put forward, and all the people who receive it are invited to make that theirs. They join in. And this is why the song supposedly, according to Mr. Holmes, swept the country. Because when the invitation went out, the people said, yes, I'll join. And when the miner started a song, I wouldn't be surprised that having been underground and the rough company that it was, there's a lot of choral directors that couldn't have stood listening to that song. It wasn't that great of a tune. But men heard it, and men listened, and they heard the invitation, and they made the decision to join in. And this is the glory of the communal expression of I, what it can be and what it can do, where the invitation goes out. It's hard. I find in myself something that wants to control and move and direct people very much. And to think about a way of administration or a way of doing leadership that uses invitation rather than coercion is not easy for me to think through. But the communal expression of I lives on the invitation rather than the coercion element of how you interact with people. And this man, whoever he was, personal voice requires personal commitment to join. But especially in church life, we are living in a voluntary world. When's the last time you thought about how voluntary the gospel is? We say a time and time again that church membership is voluntary, and we know what we mean by that. Well, I'd like to ask the question on top of that one, what else in the gospel is voluntary? What if it's everything? What if it's anything you can put your mind to? Whosoever will may come, and some do, and some don't. And some come and stay a while, then go. And some come and only come halfway and want to define it and declare it. There's a sense in which when we get up against the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, the voluntary aspect never goes away. It's just there all the time. And what I love about this communal expression of I put myself down there in the vein of the coal, and I say, would I or would I not have joined in the song? I probably would have, because I would have been pretty desperate too, but I didn't have to. And this is a dynamic of working with people that is beautiful in the sense that it aligns itself with the gospel and all the free will aspects that go with it. Salvation, church membership, Bible obedience, the offered graces of bearing one another's burdens, weeping with them that weep, and laughing with those that love are all things that we do out of the voluntary expression of our heart, not because we are reprogrammed computers that do what we're told to do. Now, sometimes our love is so great that it looks that way on the outside. But I think that one of the beauties of this is knowing the invitation aspect of the communal the communal power of I. The third element that goes with this is inspiration and bonding. You can tell I made these labels up. They're not very clean and crisp. But I'm talking about now of what happens when people are offered an invitation and they take it and they join in. And what comes next is cohesion What comes next is a beautiful working together. There's a bonding. You see, you and I singing together because you started the song. You and I meditating together because you preached the sermon, or you wrote the book article for Pilgrim Witness, or whatever it is. You and I meditating together, you and I praying together is going to pull us together. What happens when men march to the battlefield singing the same song? They're ready to fight, okay? What happens when men crouch in the dark and sing the same song together? Fear leaves and calm comes. And there is something we draw from each other when the communal expression of I is going on that I don't know how to get any other way. And it's a glorious thing. For you see, what happens when the communal expression of I is able to take place, we get one of the treasures that is very important to us. And the label we give this treasure is unity. Now, unity is a term that I have found to be both important and intriguing, because it feels to me many times in life that the more I make unity an objective, and the more I require it, and the more I demand it, the farther it gets away from me. Does that mean that it's a fake desire? Does that mean that it's a fake opportunity? Not at all. It just means that maybe it doesn't quite come with the recipe we first thought of. Another book that I read recently was a story of a man from Berks County that went to World War II. And it was just his life story. It was very interesting. But one of the things that stood out to me in that book was he was part of the movement that came down the Rhine to the final cleanup of World War II when Germany was being overtaken. And one of the things that Clarence Moyer was so shocked was to discover that in spite of the extreme control of the Nazis, they didn't have their people with them. The people were constantly undermining them. And they would rejoice when the Americans came. And even though the Gestapo would be in the village with their rifles drawn, threatening to kill anybody that does anything, they didn't have the people. And it just shows me that it is possible that the more I try to coerce a unified result, the farther it could possibly get away from me. And here's a way that we might be able to get more satisfactory fruit, where we put forth the truth, and it's our truth, and we hold it up and allow and invite the people to come eat of it as well. And the joy and the delight that comes with it gives us the fruit that we desired all along. It's kind of complicated, and I'm not sure it's always going to work to my own satisfaction, but I do think that when it works, when it happens, as it seems to be described in the scriptures and in human life, it will be a tasty fruit when we have it. Well, let's talk yet a little bit about some practical ways. We could admire the stories for a long time, but let's talk about some practical ways that we can exercise this communal power of I. And again, I just want to say what I said a little bit ago, and that is I think we ought to think about this and pursue this expression, because we are not always going to be satisfied with the results if we try to control and force. If you ask me, I would like to have a church that exercises the doctrine of separation and non-resistance and stewardship. These are the cardinal doctrines of the church. I think we all want that. But we grapple with how to get it. And this is a way to get it. I will tell you that I have a desire that when I go into Tyrone, a couple miles from my house, and I come down to the red light beside the Burger King in the Washington, the Pennsylvania house, there on Washington and 12th, that it would do something for me to see one more covered head and one less tattooed man. It would do something for me to look across the street and say, I know he's a child of the King. And I pray about that routinely. But it's not happening, even though I want it. And about the only way I know to make a difference is to somehow go to those people, Tyrone. I can't tell them to just get off of welfare and get a life. We have one of the highest rate percentages in the state. There they are, sitting on their porches, 400 or 500 pounds, smoking on their smartphones, just engulfed in themselves. And I wish they would know Jesus. But I can't force them. But I can invite them through my offers and pull them in. That's an option I have. So how do you do it? How do you offer and invite your own children to take up the gospel? I know in generations past there were people that said, if you don't smoke, I'll buy you a car. And if you join the church, I'll give you this. I've never seen data on how well that worked out, but I have my suspicions. There's got to be a better way, isn't there? What is it? Number one, when you stop and think about the whole control factor, and you know that you can't really control the voluntary aspects of the gospel, then we have to go back in the three elements I gave you, the offering, the invitation, and the inspiration. And you realize that what you hold in your hands is either an offering or an invitation. That's all you can do. Okay? But what can I offer? What song could I start that would invite them in? I'll tell you one right away, and that's your personal testimony. I have a question for you. When you look at our churches, are you satisfied with the ability of our people to give their testimony? Be interesting. A couple years ago, I was at the National Water Quality Convention, and before they opened the trade floor and before the seminar started, they had this general session. And at the end of the general session, they had this question and answer period, but it wasn't the typical one. It was where they put questions up, and you had a little device beside your seat, and you would, and they were making a survey that went right up on the screen. I wish I could do that right now and just ask you all if you're okay with the amount of testimony that's coming out of your congregations. If you have a week of revivals, and Friday night the speaker simply says, not tonight, I just rather than an invitation, I'm just going to open it up. What's the Lord been doing in your life? What do you consider to be an acceptable amount of testimony? If 100 people are there, do you expect one or two, or do you expect 10 or 20, or do you expect 50%? What's normal? Or what do you expect? Maybe that's not the same thing. I think we're weak in this area, very, very weak. I find that our people struggle to know what a testimony even is. I learned what a testimony was when I went to Bible school as a Bible school principal. I had some ideas before, but I learned that a testimony, well, the dictionary says it's an open acknowledgement or it's a public profession of a religious experience, but that young people were going to go do prison meetings, and the one had to give his testimony, and he was grappling. What do I say? And I remember one of the teachers said, oh, it's simple. It's three things. It's what I was, it's what I am now, and it's what made the difference. I used to have achy bones. I used to be able to get up in the morning, but I drank this stuff, and now I can get up. And you put it in the budget, and it sells. Do the same thing with your gospel. Do you know what you were? Do you know what you are? Do you know what made the difference? Will you tell someone? Even if it's your own brothers and sisters who've experienced the same thing. Do you know that when you stand up in that little testimony meeting and you start to talk like that, people will listen. They'll say, that's me too. And their heart will be warmed, and their heart will be inspired, and somebody else may do the same thing. And after a while, the moderator has to shut it down because the babies want lunch, okay? And this is where you can sow and serve the communal expression of I to a glory, okay? I thought of it. We don't even have testimony time here at conference. We have open discussion, which is not the same thing. Open discussion is where you talk about things that, I don't know. Edwin, maybe you want to have opened up testimony time. The preachers don't like open discussion anyway, do they? If you're up here preaching, you don't even want to have it. What would serve us so much better is for you all to just take the offering and give it, whatever that would be. But the testimony is not just there. We go to council meeting. Now, some congregations will ask three questions and expect three yeses. And you know what? For what you're doing there, a yes answer is enough. Maybe you don't find it too inspiring, and maybe it starts to seem rote or ritual after a while, but it is enough. But many of our congregations were given the opportunity to share our testimony, and this is not the time to read Psalm 23. I know that when we're emotionally down and our minds are at low gear and they don't work very well, it's really, really helpful to turn liturgical and grasp a psalm and say, "This is me." But when you're giving your testimony, surely you can do better than that. And just read a Bible verse and say, "And I'm at peace with God." Tell the people. I was so blessed in one of our congregations. We were having our council meeting, and the one young teenage girl said something like this. She said, "Well, it's time for our testimony." I was asking my sister, "What do you say?" And she said, "My sister told me that," I don't have this word for word, but it was about what she said. "My sister told me that you just give a testimony of what happened in the last 6 months and where all you've grown." And she said, "Now I feel worse yet because I can't figure out where I grew in the last 6 months, and I feel bad about that." That was a testimony. Okay? She said 10 times more than if she'd have read, "I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, not I, but Christ liveth in me." That's beautiful. That's wonderful. And there's a place for that. But when you're giving your testimony, be real. And that's what the young lady did. And you know what? It blessed the congregation. They seized the invitation. And even grandmas could listen to that young lady and say, "You know, sometimes I wonder where I've all grown in the last six months, too." And people were united together, okay? This is the power of testimony. But the power of testimony, the offering of testimony, goes beyond these public testimony moments. It goes into when it's your turn to have a devotional meditation or your turn to preach. It goes into when it is our brother's turn to have a prayer meeting topic. Recently, I've been trying to stress in our congregations the opportunity that prayer meeting is, not just to pray, but for a place where brother teaches brother. Sunday school is the same. Look, not everybody's going to be this teacher every Sunday morning. Does that mean you go offering less to Sunday school? Why would you not open your quarterly and read that lesson and answer those questions and come with a testimony to share of 1 Corinthians 13, 1 Corinthians 11, 1 Corinthians 14. We're studying that right now. But are you studying it? Or are you simply waiting for the food to come to you when you get there Sunday morning? We're looking at ways that we can invite people into the gospel and unite us. And these are little ways. I probably shouldn't say this, but there are days that I wish, I don't know how to say this, that it's going to sound right, but we need to elevate this dynamic of the offering that comes out of us and our people, whether it's the council meeting, whether it's the open testimony period, whether it's the Sunday school. Moments of silence at Sunday school are not good enough. And I'm talking 10, 20, 40, and 50-second silences. There's no excuse for it. Not since we have all the materials at our fingertips to study and be channeled into the same discussion. The second offering that I can give, or the second place where an invitation that I thought of, and these are just random things as I gave my mind to where all could I do this, is in our attendance. My testimony was first, my attendance is second. Hebrews 10:24 says that we ought not to forsake the assembly of ourselves together. Do you understand that something happens when you go to church, and it's not just happening to you? This is actually something that happens. Has anyone here ever felt the difference in inspiration between a Sunday morning service when everybody's gathered together and in their places sitting quietly, and a Wednesday night where only half the people showed up? What is that mystical difference between the two attitudes? Nothing more than the single personal offering of attendance. Okay? And we dare never minimize this. Be there. Be on time. Only some of us are diligent about being on time. I saw it again this morning, and I remembered Brother Sidney, one of the first conferences I went to, just standing up here wringing his hands. He said, "We still haven't gotten over this thing of coming to conference 15 minutes late. When's it going to change?" Is that what we do at our wife's funeral or our daughter's wedding? So what's the difference? Values. That's all it is, just values. Unless the broken world we live got in the way. Now that does happen. It's possible to be driving down the road and come upon a blocked road because of an accident. Hence I am 10 minutes late. But it's not normal. And there is such a thing as normal tardiness in our churches. And I think we're okay with it because it just goes on. As far as I know, we're okay with it because it never changes. It's been historically there with us. We're okay with not attending. Ever since I was in school, I knew the difference between a sick day and playing hooky. And we still know the difference today. Tardiness is what it is. My attendance, be there. I just see this. Maybe I'm the weird one of all of you, but I don't know why it makes such a difference, but to see empty seats in church continually bugs me. But rather than being bugged by it, why don't I just go? You know, one of the beautiful things about what attendance does in an offering, an invitation, and then an inspiration, I learned about 16 years ago. I knew about it before, but it was riveted that morning after Brother Raymond died at Shirksville. We had the funeral on Saturday, and Sunday morning I walked into church. Now, it was not unheard of that seat right there where Nelson is sitting would be empty. He was an aged man and frail. But there was always, we knew there was going to be a reason. And when I walked in the back of that church that morning and I saw no bald head, he always wore his plain suit. His circulation was terrible, even in July. No plain suit sitting up there. I saw a hole. And it stunned me for a moment to realize that something was going to be missing in the assembly from now on. But one of the things I thought about as I stood back there, there's always a cycle that went, you know, a 10, 15-second cycle, and that was over. But a voice said within me, "So, Dwayne, why don't you go sit in that seat? And let the Shirksville people know that that seat will have Dwayne in it." Now, sometimes we say, well, preachers shouldn't sit up front because it makes them look high and mighty. You can look at it that way, but you can also look at it that when pastor takes his place on the front corner, I am here and I'm here to worship, the people will pull inspiration from that. Okay? So just go ahead and fill it up. Just be there. And call our people to do the same. This is the communal expression of I in full display. Some of the simple little graces that are done in our church life. One more. This is a small, obscure one, but it did come to mind as I meditated. Ways that I can become the offering, and that is the offering. All of our churches, predominantly on Sunday mornings, but other times, there is a song and a basket that's passed. What do you do with that basket? 1 Corinthians 16, when you're gathered together upon the first day of the week, lay aside so that no offerings need to be taken later. There is a grace and a place for the communal expression of I that takes place when the ordinance of giving is fulfilled, right in the assembly. It's an ordinance. It is where we give back to God, knowing that He has given to us. The highest expression of giving hardly even looks at the checkbook and decides how much is there. Now, we have to be real. and you can't give something that isn't there. I was a deacon one time, and twice checks bounced in the offering. They're not much good in that. It happens. Most, as far as I know, both of them were mistakes, but it happens. All I'm saying is, though, brothers and sisters, why don't you just realize that if you want to develop this glorious unity that can come in a congregation, you have the opportunity to think about it before you ever go to church. They're going to lift an offering for the pilgrim mission. Let's see what we can do. And the song is raised, the basket is passed, and I put my offering in. And it goes to the right, and I put my offering in. It goes to the right, and I put my offering in. And the invitation is going out. And this is one of the aspects of our church life where the communal expression of I pulls us together and inspires us. And at the end of the service, the deacon or the board say, and Brotherhood Assistants, we were counted on for $34,000, and we gave $35,110. And the people go home with joy. They could go home with pride too, but that's another problem. But they can go home with joy because everybody, one by one, breathed the air that was in the room. And one became many, and all became one. It's just a simple little grace that's right in our midst, and we can practice it. The communal power of I is a very powerful opportunity of brotherhood. I propose that it just might well be the most powerful one. We don't even have to exactly know about it to use it, to enjoy it, and to be strengthened by it. But I do believe that a church without it is done. May God help us.